Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Getting a good start. Pope Benedict celebrates the new academic year for Rome's pontifical universities and institutes of higher education. Integration and understanding, how the Catholic Church in Ireland is meeting the challenges of an evolving school system. And development and globalization, the UN focuses on goals for the new millennium. We hear from the Holy See's permanent observer to the UN and from a member of Britain's House of Lords on the challenges and the good that has been accomplished so far. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Those are the stories we'll be looking at over the next half hour. Thanks for joining me. Getting off to a good start. Pope Benedict celebrated Mass Monday evening in St. Peter's Basilica for students and professors from the pontifical universities and institutes here in Rome, marking the beginning of their academic year. There are 16 pontifical institutions of higher learning here in Rome, plus a number which offer limited academic programs. These institutions offer courses for more than 17,000 students from all over the world, many of them religious, but also a good number of lay men and women. The courses range from theology and religion, of course, but also to Christian and classical literature, communications, psychology, and social sciences. Emma McCarthy has more on Monday's liturgical celebrations.
Benedict XVI greeted students from the Pontifical Institutes of Higher Learning Monday as they gathered in St. Peter's to mark the beginning of the academic year in Rome.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, sono lieto di incontrarvi al termine della Santa Messa e di potervi così porgere i miei auguri per il nuovo anno accademico.
The Pontifical Gregorian University, the Pontifical St. Thomas Aquinas University, and the Pontifical University of the Holy Cross are just some of the many institutions dedicated to furthering Catholic education, all directly linked to the Holy See. Pope Benedict XVI joined the students and academic staff at the end of Mass, celebrated by Cardinal Zenon Gracolewski, Prefect of the Congregation for Catholic Education.
Beatissimo Padre, la comunità dei docenti, i numerosi studenti, sono particolarmente lieti e incontrandosi con il successore del primo degli apostoli.
The Holy Father highlighted the universality of the institutes, which draws students from parishes and dioceses throughout the world, which he says in turn underlines the universality of the Catholic Church and her teachings. The Pope also reaffirmed the importance of spiritual life and the constant need to nurture and care for the spiritual aspect of the person. He reminded students, among which number many seminarians, that consideration of Christian truth and theological study require silence and contemplation in order to fully understand Christ's revelation.
And thanks there to Emer McCarthy for that report. Well, just how are some academic institutions in other countries tackling the challenges of their specific communities? Coming up next, overcoming decades of sectarian strife and social inequalities in Ireland. Education for Mutual Understanding. That's just one of a number of projects launched in Ireland over the past decade to bring children of different religions and social backgrounds closer together. The people in Ireland, and particularly in Northern Ireland, are keenly aware of the need to build bridges between different communities as they work to put more than 30 years of sectarian violence behind them. Traditionally, parents there have chosen to send their children to Catholic or to Protestant schools according to the religious tradition they follow. Analysts say the system remains largely segregated today, but new so-called integrated schools have also evolved in a social experiment which mixes children from the two main Christian traditions with those from other or no faiths. Catholic schools have been among those to receive government financial support by adapting their curricula to a national education scheme. They have also always accepted kids from multicultural backgrounds and faiths. Emer McCarthy sat down with Bishop Donal Murray of Limerick, Ireland, for an eye-opening talk about the cultural and social changes in Ireland over the last decade, and particularly the role of the Catholic Church in education. Bishop Murray is the chairman for the Bishop's Department for Education.
There's been a big growth in the state sector of education. Schools that, for the most part, are very favourable to the education of Catholic students in their Catholic faith and so on. I mean, the vocational schools are always very good at that. The community colleges and schools which have grown up in the last 20 years or so have also been very good at that. But the religious control, if you like, of schools is obviously diminishing because religious are not as involved. But I don't think that necessarily should mean that because the schools are no longer staffed by sisters and brothers and so on, that they should become less Catholic. The religious made an enormous contribution in Ireland. But could I say maybe the downside of that is that perhaps the Christian community in general didn't really recognise its responsibility for education and indeed for healthcare and for all the other things that the sisters and brothers did so well. Therefore, I think one of our big tasks is to reawaken that awareness, because it seems to me that one of the fundamental things about education is that it's something that's done by a community. It's not done by the state. I mean, education is about the formation of the whole person. And Frank Sheed, the Australian writer, years ago raised the question. He said, if you ask the state what a person is, the state has to say, we don't know. Some people think the person will live forever in the eternal kingdom. Some people think a person is snuffed out at death. Some people, they have all sorts of different ideas. And the state, it's no business of the state to decide between them. And if you ask the state what's the purpose of human life, they'll say the same. It's not our business. And in fact, therefore, it's people who have a sense of these things, who can educate the whole person, who can deal with the deep questions. And I think the big challenge in education in Ireland, particularly at second and third level, is the danger of squeezing out the deep questions. So that, in fact, it becomes the preparation of people to take their place in the economy, in the political life and all that sort of thing, but not really a sense of making people more fundamentally human and more in touch with who they are. And I think that's our big challenge.
And has the Church in Ireland actually come about with any concrete decisions of how to face this challenge, any initiatives about involving the community and the lay community more, perhaps, in education itself?
Yeah, well, that's been done, I think, quite a lot by the religious congregations, who obviously have to face the question not just of, well, first of all, the question about who owns the schools and who will continue to run them as Catholic schools into the future. And obviously, most of the people who will be involved in that will be lay people. So they're involved in setting up various kinds of trusts and setting up various ways in which these trusts can be helped and encouraged to be vehicles for the maintenance of the Catholic ethos of the school. So there's a great deal of work being done there. I think there's also pastorally a greater awareness that you can't leave the schools to do this without the involvement of the community and the families. First of all, the families. But I think that, you know, we talk about what's a Catholic school. I think in a simple terms, a Catholic school is a school which is an organic part of a Catholic community. And in some ways, at second level schools, that has not been the case, because the students go maybe 10, 20 miles from their own parish to a school which is, you know, distant from them, where their own priests probably very rarely are seen, and so on. And it's a big challenge for us to ensure that these pupils don't just learn about their faith, but have experience of the Christian community. And not just the Christian community of the school, but the Christian community that they will have to be part of when they've left school. And that's something that we have to think about. And there are various initiatives being done about that, but they're kind of... We've a long way to go, I think.
A lot of people have said, with regards to Catholic education, that there seems to be a certain truncation of Catholic education once the child or the young teenager is confirmed, and then after that the input, it diminishes increasingly. Mm. As you said, the factors are various. That yeah. might be that there is a lack of stimulation within the family. Maybe the schools and the religious hours themselves aren't doing enough to promote a thorough analysis or a deeper study of catechesis. Now, a lot of people have also prayed, for example, the return to the Sunday school ethos
yeah.
that you see in the United States or you see in Great Britain. The idea of bringing a teaching of catechesis back within the parish itself, not only for adults, as in Bible study groups,
yes.
but also for children and teenagers.
Yeah.
Do you think this is possible in Ireland? Do you think this is the road we should
do it? There have been very interesting things. I mean, for the last few years, most places have been using a program called Do This in Memory. For children making their first communion, and it's actually a program whose purpose is to involve the whole community in the preparation of the children. There's a Sunday Mass once a month in which the children are the centre of it, and there's a little prayer space in the church set up to remind people every time they come into the church that the children are preparing for communion and the themes that they're being reflecting on and all that sort of thing. And I think it's been extremely effective. And I think it's actually helped people to see, parents to see, that their role in the preparation of children for First Communion is hugely important, because there was a danger that people would say, well, the school does that. And this has been a real awakening of their... And even on things like... I mean, one of the things that people have been worried about often about the First Communion is how much expense and, you know, buying all these dresses and so on. And one of the things that's perhaps emerged from this is that parents... When you give parents something, some role, other than their role on the day, that it puts these things in much better perspective, and parents are recognise that their role in preparing their child for First Communion is an ongoing one. It's not just about ensuring that their child is beautifully dressed on the day. So I think that's been a big improvement, and people are beginning to work on similar things for confirmation. The big challenge, though, as you say, is at second level schools, where they are not at school in their own parish for the most part, and how we make those links is quite difficult. I suppose when they go into secondary school, it's just the point at which they're less ready to talk about things with their own parents. So although they're not necessarily less ready to talk about them with other adults. So I think there are possibilities there, but I think we still need to think. There are good initiatives happening too, and indeed in my diocese of Limerick, there are initiatives that have been there long before I arrived in it, you know, which seem to attract young people in a particular way, because one of the most important things about it is this: it's not really a movement, because it's looser than a movement, but the most important thing about it is that when you arrive for the first time, you are welcome. And the first principle on which it's based is welcome. So, I mean, there's no examination to see, do you believe all the things you're supposed to believe, and are you doing all the things you're supposed to do, but welcome. And then there's an element of education in it, trying to help people to understand what their faith means and what it demands of them. And there's an element of prayer. Every gathering of this group has an hour of silent prayer and so on. So I think that sort of thing, and it's amazing to me to see how many people who've been through that are actually prominent in their own parishes now, 10, 15, 20 years later.
You brought up a very interesting topic there, the idea of the new communities and ecclesial movements, which we have seen are extremely popular within the church on the continent, in the United States, in Australia, and to a lesser extent on the African continents. Is this something you think the bishops of Ireland would welcome as a into Ireland, working in collaboration, obviously, with the parishes to try and, shall we say, renew a certain interest and involvement within the local parishioners?
I would say, yes, but I think that they are there. They don't seem to have grown at the same pace in Ireland, and I think maybe that, to come back to what I was saying a moment ago, maybe we need to design something ourselves, like that initiative that happened in Limerick 30 years ago, which will give people this sense of being part of a community where it's all right to be Catholic and to talk about it and to pray about it and so on. Like the kind of community that exists briefly on a World Youth Day, for instance, or that exists briefly when people go to help the sick in Lourdes. And the amazing thing is that when you see young people in those situations, they don't feel restricted because there's not a disco every night or because of whatever. They actually feel liberated. And it shows us that if we could actually produce that kind of thing on a more regular basis, then I think we'd find there the solution to a lot of problems, like, for instance, vocations. How many young people, young men, say, at the age of 17, think they might like to be a priest, but they don't know where they could say that without being laughed at? When they eventually, some of them do decide to go at the age of 27 or 37, because they realise it's their own lives and they should do what they... At that stage, how many of their people who also had vocations have met a nice young woman and they're happily married and so on, and we say where the vocation's gone, that's one of the places they're gone. That people didn't feel sustained by the community and challenged by the community and supported by the community in responding to their vocation.
Very warm thanks there to Bishop Donal Murray of Limerick, Ireland. He was speaking there to Emer McCarthy. Tuesday marks celebrations for United Nations Day, which focuses this year on development objectives for the new millennium. It is also the World Day for Information on Development. Well, leading up to the UN events, the Acton Institute, a think tank for the study of religion and liberty, hosted a conference here in Rome on globalization and poverty. Catherine Smybert was there.
One of the key speakers at the event was the Holy See's permanent observer to the UN office in Geneva, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi. He gave a stark assessment of where poverty reduction efforts have come over the past 6 years since the Millennium Development Goals were drawn up.
I think we have to start with one fact, that most of the African countries south of the Sahara will not meet any of the Millennium Development Goals. So I think that's a kind of red light of alarm. 1 billion people live with less than $1 a day, and 2 billion people live with less than $2 a day. So there is a huge gap between rich and poor in the world still now, notwithstanding enormous efforts made in terms of direct aid for development, giving cash for development to some governments, and also some transfer of technology and know-how. So some of us are looking at this panorama around the world, and the data that are provided by the agencies of the United Nations, on the basis of the very information provided by these agencies, we can see that there has been some kind of a failure in bringing out of poverty most of the world. Now, it's interesting that through the process of liberalization of trade and the globalization of the markets, in the last few years, some 300 million people, especially in China and India, have been moved out. They have graduated, so to say, out of poverty into a more acceptable lifestyle. But what is that compared to the huge numbers that are still in poverty? I think it's a positive achievement that probably points out the road we need to follow in order to help other people to get out of poverty.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi there, but opening the Acton event held at the Pontifical Urban University was actually Lord Brian Griffiths, an Anglican member of the House of Lords in London and former advisor to Britain's former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. He underlined the importance of recognising the role of Christian thought in the evaluation of such issues of globalisation and poverty.
I would say today that the great danger from a Christian point of view is that the whole debate on globalization is seen almost entirely in secular terms. So the terms of the debate, the way it's conducted, it's all about money, it's about foreign aid, it's about trade liberalization. You know, it's that kind of debate, and we've taken, but we know as Christians that the heart of life is fundamentally spiritual. And I think therefore the challenge is, how can we as Christians express our concern, as Jesus did, for the poor? But how also can we ensure that in what we're doing, we're not simply the same as government departments or international agencies, but that we really bring that Christian spirit to bear in the way that we do things? And in Deus Caritas Est, Pope Benedict XVI makes it very clear that the church is an expression of something unique because it is the Spirit of Christ. And I have to say, I have found over 40 years that this is the most relevant thing to our current economic challenges.
Now, globalization is said to be a recent phenomenon. Could you comment on this?
Well, globalization has really, I think, expanded enormously since the 1970s. And the symbol is Deng Xiaoping, the premier of China, opening up China to the world economy. But since then, and you've seen dramatic success in China. And now in India, you know, the amount, for example, of foreign investment going into China is more than the whole of foreign aid given to the developing countries. But globalization is not a new phenomenon. If you go back to the 19th century, you saw a lot of globalization in the 19th century, and probably the belle époque of globalization was the 25 years before the First World War.
Globalization is a very controversial phenomenon, and some tend to see and emphasize its more negative aspects. What are the roots of these negative criticisms, and to what extent can we agree with them?
Well, first of all, I would say that the major criticisms of globalization come from people who lose out to it, because there are winners in globalization and there are losers. For example, If you go back to the demonstrations at Genoa, and, you know, very tough demonstrations we've had against the IMF and the World Bank, who are the people who are at the heart of them? Well, they're ideological Marxists, but there are members of American trade unions who fear they lose jobs, that jobs are moving to China. There are people who represent farm subsidies and the farming lobbies who also lose out to globalization. So that, I think, is the sort of the major concern with it, is that in Britain, for example, we are finding jobs are moving in the service industry from London to India. You know, the back offices of accounting firms, investment banks, people making hospital x-rays. These can be done overnight in India and sent back very conveniently the next day. So those are the people who say globalization is bad. But if you look at it overall, there's no doubt China has had a rate of economic growth for the last 25 years of nearly 10%. And China is being transformed. India is now, there's so much activity taking place. Markets are really coming to life. And poor countries are really benefiting from it.
So what are the significant concerns over globalization?
Well, there are many, but people come from various ideological backgrounds in presenting these concerns. But I would say one concern is that institutions like the IMF and the World Bank have imposed their worldview too much on developing countries, and especially poor countries who are not in a position to resist them. Secondly, there's a concern that globalization is leading to environmental problems for which there's no real control. Thirdly, and it's something that Pope John Paul II emphasized, and that is that some people feel globalization has become a vehicle for a very libertarian and non-Christian culture.
Brian Griffiths, a member of Great Britain's House of Lords, speaking to Catherine Smybert. Earlier you heard Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. You can catch more from that interview with the Archbishop tomorrow on the feature program. That's Wednesday, October 25th, in the evening Rome time, and again on Thursday, October 26th, in the morning. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.